The following is a part of the Radio Memphis On Demand service. It originally aired live on Radio Memphis and has been edited for time.
That is Eric Scott for you right here on Radio Memphis Around the World. You're tuning in radio-memphis.com with me, D. And that song you heard right there is called Nine Lives. And that is off the Company of Clouds album. And that song is absolutely just brilliant. Because here's a man who's been a force in the contemporary instrumental music scene since, I mean, pretty much 2008. Now, what you may not know about Eric Scott is that, you know, he's a professional composer and musician. He's done it for more than 40 years. He has actually toured the planet and played bass for musical duo Flo and Eddie. Okay, remember, featuring members of the Turtles. He's done stuff with Alice Cooper, and he even produced a couple of records for Alice. He's even wrote and recorded music for a variety of TV hit shows, including Starsky and Hutch, Charlie's Angels, Vegas, The Love Boat. Oh my God, you guys remember The Love Boat? He's even done stuff for National Lampoon's Vacation. Now, in the 90s, he actually became one of the founding members of Sonia Dada, and that's a Chicago-based kind of rock, soul, R&B band, and they wound up reaching number one on the Australian music charts with their self-titled debut album. Now, Eric was also the co-writer, and of course, for those of you that are into the blues, and of course, Memphis, that's really close and near and dear to our heart. He's a co-writer of Father, Father, the title track for gospel R&B legend Pops Staples album. That album won a Grammy Award for Best Contemporary Blues Album in 94. Now, that eventually led Eric to working with Mavis Staples on her 2004 record, Have a Little Faith. Now, of course, as the 2000s progressed, he drew his attention towards his solo projects, and he's done solo albums including Other Planets, and The Earth Bleeds, Spirits, and of course, you know, his latest accomplishment, which you just heard right here on Radio Memphis, In the Company of Clouds. Now, that album right there, it took top accolades of Album of the Year and Best Contemporary Instrumental Album at the ZMR Awards, okay? And that ZMR Award ceremony was actually this past May in New Orleans. Now, having shared pretty much world stages with some pretty cool people, think Doobie Brothers, Jefferson Starship, Stephen Stills, Fleetwood Mac, he's even collaborated with Carl Palmer, Kim Carnes. I mean, oh my God, he's seen a lot when it comes to the business of music and entertainment. Now, what the cool thing is, I did find out what you may not know about Eric. And of course, those of you who know Eric Scott and know him very, very personally, you know, and that he probably is near and dear to your heart, you probably are more fondly know him as Esky. That he pretty much got his start in the fourth grade with one of the most sexiest instruments of all time, the trombone. And, you know, after really kind of diving into this and diving into his music and where he's been and the fact that he continues to reinvent himself, we felt the need that we needed to talk with him and see what he's got going on now and see what kind of advice and what kind of stuff that he can offer to the up-and-comers and things like that. So I want to bring in Mr. Eric Scott live with us right now. How are you doing, honey?
I'm doing good. My goodness, after that call, it sounds like I should be tired.
I tried to make it short, but you know, I've left out like a lot of details.
Well, there's a lot of years that you can't possibly, you know.
You can't. I want to thank you for taking some time this afternoon. Of course, your morning. You know, for hanging out with us, and you know, because I know you're on the West Coast, and to be able to talk about, you know, your music, your career, and actually just to have some fun with me, you know, on Radio Memphis Around the World. So you and I actually get to sit down and have a cool conversation.
I love Memphis is a great town, obviously an historical music town, and besides the barbecues, so and the Peabody Hotel and the Commodore.
Yes, you've spent some time here, and it's funny because, you know, when we were, you know, I was telling everybody all the stuff that you've done, and I was, you know, and you have figured out that, you know, I do a lot of stalking, I do a lot of digging, and I try to find out even more information, and I was, you know, and it was just so cool, you know, to see the stuff come up with you know, Pops and come up with Mavis Staples and stuff, because, you know, we personally, you know, at Radio Memphis Around the World, or Radio Memphis, you know, we actually have a big thing with the Booze and Blues, the show that we do on Sunday nights. We do a lot of stuff with the blues community, and of course, North Mississippi All-Stars, you know, Mavis does a lot of stuff with them. And so when I was seeing this, you know, kind of, you know, back and forth connection, I was like, man, this is brilliant. This is awesome. Totally love that. And I know that's a big thing for you.
Well, it was fun. You know, I had some time off in Chicago, and there was a fella producing who knew Mavis, had worked on her album and was producing Pops, and said, he called me up in a hotel, that's what it was, and he says, I'm doing some stuff with Pops Staples, he's doing her an album, do you, you know, want to try to write a song? So I had a night off, so I went over there, and, you know, just got a little drum machine and put up a little beat, and started doing a thing called a guitar player, we knew it, and we just played just super simple. It's just a really simple groove type of thing. And then I went away. Then about a month later, Richard called me up and says, because Pops and Mavis had come over to hear what he had. And wow. So he played him five things. And apparently they dug, Pops in particular, dug what my track was.
Sure.
Play me that one where the bass is dragging again. And so that's, then they wrote words to it. And, you know, next thing I know, it's the title cut and he wins a Grammy. And
isn't that crazy? I mean, and it happened just like that. I mean,
yeah, you know, so many in the recording, sometimes you aren't, and the same thing with Mavis, to be honest. That was a one time only, and the producer of her was doing it, and I went over and I played on the record, and later she sang out, she wasn't there at the time, and later she sang out, and actually got Blues Gospel Song of the Year, so for a minute, I thought I should change out of the rock R&B business and go into gospel.
Yeah.
Because it was working, but. You know, and I met her later when we played live, but sometimes you'll, especially in the writing portion of the program, you'll write something and not necessarily have met the artist that you're writing for.
Right, right. And then next thing you know, it all kind of pans out. And, you know, and for those of you that have tuned in, I'm talking to Eric Eske Scott. I want to go back for a second because, you know, ultimately, you know, you showed up in my world, you know, with some of the other stuff that I'm doing, you know, here for Radio Memphis. I started doing some stuff with the Road Crew radio series, and I actually got to sit down and I got to talk to Mickey. I got to talk to your wife first.
Mm-hmm.
And of course with all the gang and stuff, and as things really kind of progressed, you know, knowing about all the cool stuff that you've done in the music, a lot of people, you know, don't realize that, you know, you pretty much started out as, you know, kind of a rocker, you know,
kind of a rocker,
and of course, you know, coming into the ranks with Flo and Eddie, and coming into the ranks of Alice Cooper, it is for me, it is such a treat to see the music that you do now, because, you know, that just ultimately tells me that you just love music, you know, and you just have these things in you, and, you know, somehow you're going to plug in, and somehow you're going to fit in somewhere. But I want to go back, because, you know, one of the beautiful things and one of the funny things. You know, especially you and I got to talk on the phone for a few, and I did see this, where your start was in the fourth grade with the trombone.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like you were going for the trombone. I think you were trying to be a drummer.
Well, something sexy, something cool at that point in time. This was, you know, 1842.
Stop
the cool
it.
Things were trumpet and drums. So yeah, that's what I was in the school band. You couldn't play guitar because they didn't have that yet in fourth grade back in when I was in fourth grade.
Sure.
In the 50s. So yeah, I was looking for something with a little more panache. When I went in there and the music teacher looked at me, looked at my teeth, I was like a horse, opened up my mouth, looked at it, and gave me the damn trombone.
And so when you saw this thing, I mean, what were you thinking?
Well, I was, you know, I was kind of in the band because my mom thought I should, you know, I liked music, but trombone wasn't, you know, I didn't. You kidding? Really?
You can't pick up chicks with a trombone.
You know, I said, okay, fine. It became more of a duty at that point as I played trombone through grade school and high school. And I was apparently good at it because I got first chair, but
oh,
I was not devoted, if you know what I mean.
I do. And so you wind up, okay, so you go through it. But ultimately being in the band, you know, at school, you know, obviously, you know, gave you some chops and obviously gave you the understanding as far as, you know, music and, you know, and how it's, you know, how it's written and, you know, and how it's composed, you know, and things like
You'd think so. I'm not sure it did, you know, because when I went into the rock thing, it was all headspace. I've never learned to really read in the rock or never really had to read in the recording businesses I've chosen. I mean, a lot of guys can and do, the ones to play in orchestras and do charts and jingles. I did one jingle. That's a long story.
That's okay. We got time.
Well, I did a couple albums in Northern Illinois, you know, Otis Plum, and the album was Food, actually, on Capitol in 1969, and it failed miserably, and we had a group called Food. It was a trio. Guitar, bass, drums. It was wonderful, you know, like 71. And we rocked great, almost got a deal. Eventually we got a deal and played for A&M Records and changed the name of the band to Jambalaya because the singer came in, P. Peter McKeon, who ended up producing Men at Work, interestingly enough.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, we made an album, and it didn't work either, so it came time, after one more thing, to go to... I started going, well, the only thing available was in Chicago, and that was more or less jingles. So I went down there. I couldn't read, but I heard this one guy, and this one producer said, well, that's cool, because I got there early, half hour. I said, I don't read well, but Bill Trott at Wood Nickel Records had recommended me. So I showed up, and it was turned out to be a 30-second spot for the Chicago Blackhawks hockey team.
Okay.
And he wanted it to rock a bit. So I just started playing some riffs, you know, in the tempo that he wanted. And he said, oh, that's cool, that's good. In E, and just started doing what a rock guy would do, and a jingle writer probably wouldn't write. So he said, well, that works great.
Okay.
So then I started having a great relationship with him, and he passed me to a few other guys with that stipulation that I couldn't really read, don't call them in for charts, but call them in, show them what you want.
Right.
They'll probably come up with something if it's in a rock idea that might be better than you would have written.
Sure.
And so I think I did a dozen of those, and it was getting good. And then I finally got a call from Dick Marks, who was the guy, Universal.
Oh, wow.
In Chicago.
Okay.
And I was at that time working night jobs at the A&P food store in the Midwest. I call it the A&P feed store. But I was working up all night, and we were trying to make a record in the day. And then I'd go down, and I did this jingle. And then I walked in, and he says, carrying my bass, I'd been up all night, you know, stacking cans in the food store.
Of course.
And he says, I said, hi, America. He says, oh, I've heard about you. You better be good. And I went, oh, fuck. I already, oh, excuse me. Can you say that on private radio?
You can. Okay. Yeah, well, you're good.
I'll tap it down a little bit. So I went in there, and it was a 4-page chart. I needed 3 music stands to hold this thing. And I knew that I was up the creek without a paddle. And so I did it, you know, because they had an orchestra. They had 30 people there. Singers was a Budweiser commercial. And they had singers and an orchestra on the track. And holy golly. So it didn't work out really well. I made it through it. But they had to stop it, actually, a couple times for the bass player. And then I said, you know, I hate this. I'm going to L.A. I don't want to do jiggles. So I went out there. And in all my years in Los Angeles doing sessions, the only thing that they give you out there is, you know, if it charts, the singer might come in and just start playing it, and you make your own roadmap off a demo or something.
Right.
Or they write, and the chart would be in E, A minor,
mm-hmm.
no note charts. So it's a good thing I moved.
Yeah, no doubt. That way you were able to at least kind of roll through it and map it out.
Can you imagine? I mean, I look back at that with horror. There's 30 people around, orchestras and background singers and the whole shebang, and I'm... Yeah, I'm desperately looking at the chart trying to figure out what the hell I'm supposed to play.
You needed to be in that moment, though. Think about it, Eric. I mean, you know, it really molded you into somebody you are right now. You know,
I can't. It's one of those get the hell out of here moments.
Well, I mean, okay, he told you what you didn't want to do, but at the same time...
You were a round peg and this is a square hole.
You still... Oh, my goodness. Now, look. All right, so you try to get through all of this and make it all work. Now, how is it... Okay, tell me how you wind up, you know... There's Carl Palmer, okay? Because I know that you've done that stuff before you kind of went into Flo and Eddie, or is that reverse? Am I thinking reverse?
Reverse. What happened to Carl Palmer? After Flo and Eddie, 79... I was doing L.A. Los Angeles sessions, an album, and co-producing, starting to get into some production chops and some playing, and I had gone out in a row with Tony O'Kay. Did you ever hear of him?
I've heard of the name, but you can tell me about it because I want to learn.
Well, he was a left turn. He got a deal because of Warren Zevon's success. He was not pop mainstream. He had the Funky Western Civilization. That was the title of his first album, and he was kind of a punk rocker. But anyway, I went out. I started an album with him and went on a short tour with him and Earl Slick. Remember him from the David Bowie days? And
oh,
stuff?
Wow. Wow, wow, yes.
And we went out and toured for a bit. And I got a call. Anyway, from out of that, Emerson, Lake & Palmer broke up, and I got a call and I went back to L.A. to go see if I wanted to. So I went down there because they had gone through... they had everybody in the band, apparently, but they had not had the bassist because nobody had fit the bill. And they had some great guys.
Sure.
I mean, guys who were... on albums and Mars, I can't imagine, but I don't know why they didn't get the gigs. But it didn't really work, to be honest with you. The guitar player, great friend, he's a good guy, Barry Finnerty. He had just finished playing the lead guitar on the Crusaders, Street Life.
Oh, wow.
And had a job offer from Miles Davis.
Damn.
And And he was great, but he was not a rocker. You know, he gets a power chord and he gets a little bit itchy about beat 2.5. He's got to start playing some ninths and some sixteenths. And I looked around the room, the piano player. Anyway, it's a long story short. That was a short-lived experiment. We went to Munich, made a bad album, and the group broke up because it was a bad record.
Okay.
And unfortunately, it didn't work because the chemistry just wasn't right for the people, and he wanted it to be a rock album. And Kyle is a fantastic orchestral drummer.
I see. I see. It's funny because you know, Eric, it's like with you. I mean, you've got both sides of the worlds that are always trying to impact the same moment. Have you noticed this just in this short conversation we've had? You know, you've got this orchestral side and then you've got this rock side, and it was like everything kept trying to get rammed into the same moment at the same time. How is it that you're always there at that moment?
I have no clue.
I mean, has anybody ever pointed that out to you?
At that time, you know, just looking for work. You know, LA, I wasn't in the Rolling Stones or any of the bigger, the groups I had started, none of them became big. You know, so when I moved to LA, because I could play a little bit, I was okay. You know, I hooked up with the Flo and Eddie, who used to be the Turtles, and they just left Zappa. And we did 3 years of constant touring and international stuff, and it was...
And I love the way you're so cool and you're so humble about it. It's like, yeah, so I was with Flo and Eddie. Anyways, it was awesome. Back up. that's a very historical piece, man. Flo, we're talking just Flo and Eddie, man. How do you wind up in their world? How do you get in their orbit? What were you doing?
Well, I moved to Los Angeles, and I was hustling around, playing any opportunity that popped up, and I had done a session out of Cherokee Studios, which at that time was still out in Chatsworth, 1974.
Right.
And because a friend had preceded me from the Northern Illinois area, and he was working as a tape opera, an intern in Cherokee, and he said they were looking for a bass player for this session or something. So I went out there and played, and it worked. It was really cool. We did a song called Harlem Shuffle, as a matter of fact, with the Robb Brothers in Cherokee.
Okay.
Anyway, Flo and Eddie had just completed their album. They had done some work at the studio, and they liked the Robb Brothers because Bruce played keyboards, he produced and engineered, and played a little guitar, and so they called him up, and they knew that Robb was recorded and had a little band session studio group going that I had now become a part of as a bassist. So they called up, and he came out and asked us if that studio group that had been recommended by Cherokee wanted to go on the road.
I see.
They just finished the album. And so that's how I got in the band. That was December 74.
Wow.
And then we did an album in 75, the Illegal, Immoral, and Fattening album.
Yes.
And 76, and toured all summer with the Starship.
That was kind of interesting for you because that was during a very critical time for that band as well.
Oh, yeah, amazing. I mean, they had the Red Octopus, which went to number one.
Yes.
And dropped off, then went back up five separate times. All summer long, it's basically number one.
See?
And there's Grace Slick and Paul Kantner and all, you know, and all Craig Jaquito had replaced Yorma, and Jack Cassidy was gone, but they had Pete Sears. And so it was a great band, and it was. And I'm, you know, the kid from Gurnee, Illinois, and people are going, where? Basically, I'm the new guy. The new guy, and now, you know, and there's Grace Slick, and so they get to see some people, and plus the Flo and Eddie were known for attracting people in the show business because they had the hit single back in like 66 or something when they were 16 and Happy Together, and they were huge as Turtles and funny, and everybody kind of loved them.
And everybody loved them. Now for you, what was it like for you, you know, being thrown into this mix, and then you start rubbing elbows and you start, you know, kind of sharing stages with some pretty cool acts and stuff. I mean, how's this impacting you and how you're looking at your career?
I'm just learning. From a playing standpoint, it was a simple gig. You know, the Turtles, the pop. And for the most part, I mean, from a chop standpoint, it was not demanding. So as a player, I could cut it. It was more how to hang, how to conduct yourself, and how to be prepared, and how to be able to do whatever is recalled for on stage. And the fact that, you know, 3 weeks into the gig, you know, Keith at the Troubadour in Los Angeles, Keith Moon and Alice Cooper come up.
The
night before
here
was Christmas Eve, and they had Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, Peter Asher, Joni Mitchell, and that crowd had come down to sing Christmas carols.
Christmas
Eve, a troubadour. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. But the next night, on Christmas night, was Alice Cooper and Keith Moon. For me, as a young rock-inclined guy, I'm thinking this is maybe a little cooler.
You were all about it.
I was definitely all up in the business. And the drummer, who had just got a new set of drums, said, "Oh, I love Keith," but no, he's not playing drums. So Keith, because you know what he used to do with drum sets, he's legendary for dismantling and destroying. And he didn't want his new Rogers set dismantled and destroyed. So he came up and he sang, and of course we did Happy Together.
Oh, how
fun. All the guitar encore. And then one other tune, and I think I may have suggested it. I like to think I did, because it was one of my go-to songs, one of my go-to kind of silly songs that you do with big stars as an encore. It was Wooly Bully.
Oh, my goodness. Right! Hell yeah! Way to go! And so that right there gets everybody.
And afterwards, it was hanging with Keith. And I didn't hang a lot with Alice that night. It was more with Keith, but 5 years later, that was 5 years before I started working with Alice. But,
wow.
So, you know, and the next year was Phone A, the next album. The next tour was with the Doobie Brothers on their Taking It to the Streets tour, which was number one. And we were doing the amphitheaters, the outdoor sheds, 18,000 every night. So. And I was meeting and rubbing, you know, shoulders and with cats who I just, you know, you hear on the radio and you see on the record sleeves when you're back in the Midwest. And
well,
so
yeah.
It was, you know, postgraduate work in the recording business.
For you, I mean, and that's you know, that's a hell of a you know, hard school, you know, but still, it's still a lot of schooling for you. And you got to, you know, you got those experiences and you're able to, you know, and that's your moment. You know, everybody wants to be like, oh my God, I wish I could hang with somebody that you're listening to on the radio. And here you are doing it. And so you're just ultimately absorbing all of this in. And in the meantime, not even realizing that you're developing your own style. And it's just blossomed into so many different things. And I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to stop down real quick, okay, Eric? I'm going to take a quick commercial break. I'm going to throw like a monkey wrench in everybody's program, because the Alice Cooper thing, we're going to come back around, you know, to that, you know, and talk about that for a second. But after this commercial break, what I am going to do is I'm going to play a song from a band of yours, Sonia Dada, which I am just completely in love with. You know, that's a home run. That sound is an awesome thing for you too. And so we're gonna play that, you know, maybe talk about that, and then we're gonna pick up where we left off on how five years after you know traipsing the world with cool people that you've idolized up until this point, and how you get into the Cooper camp. All right.
Sure.
All right. Hold tight for me right now, honey.
You bet.
Eric Dott hanging out with me this afternoon on Radio Memphis Around the World. How you doing, honey?
Doing good, thanks.
Good. Fantastic sound. That's a cool vibe right there.
It is good. It was the first track off that album, and it had some success at radio. I almost suggested another song called Lester's Methadone Clinic.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's a really cool vibe. And that being pirate radio, I thought, but I sent that other one, or I suggested the other one. Of course, if I had done it in reverse, I'd have probably said, oh, I should have done whatever.
First instinct.
Interesting genre bending situation.
Now the deal with Sonia Dada, I mean, and of course, you know, and for those of you that you're tuning in and kind of wondering what we're talking about, you're rock and soul R&B, you know, out of Chicago. Now how do you, I know that they actually the core people of the band were found, you know, singing in a subway station. Okay.
The singers, yeah.
And so how did you get wrapped up in that particular group?
I did a session. Dan Pritzker, who was writing songs, and he had a band called Idle Tears in 1986, and he came to Los Angeles to record it, and Chuck Plotkin, who had been producing Bruce Springsteen, was producing it, Ed Cherney was engineering it, and they had the band, Dan and David Resnick's guitar, and there was a keyboard, but they thought they had better get somebody with more studio experience, so for the drums and bass, they got guys that had made more records, and
right,
I was the bass player. Craig Cramp was the original drummer. Later, Steve Ferroni was also there. But so I was called in basically as a session fellow.
Okay.
There's a couple of great songs on that Idle Tears record that I was asked to co-produce it, which I did. So that established a relationship with me and Dan.
I see.
And the group was short-lived, but a couple of years later, we kept in touch because he kept writing songs, and we'd get together once or twice a year and record to see what was up with a different singer or so. And then he called me up one time in 1990 in the summer and says, I found these three singers singing in the subway in Chicago. He's going to a Cubs game.
Wow.
And he found these guys busking in the subway.
How
and so
awesome.
I went, well, cool. So we went, and so instead of looking for one singer, he found three. And so we went and got together, and these, of course, were all brothers from the south or west side of Chicago. And
right.
They had their own culture and vibe. And we were, you know, a mix of rockers and R&Bers and Grateful Dead fans and a jazz guy here and But this cross melting pot of eight guys, all from different, you know,
backgrounds, yeah,
got together and then ended up making some stuff that was kind of interesting. We kept it up for about 15 years.
It is awesome. It's very interesting and stuff. And so this is another project that you're still very active in. Is that correct?
Well, not currently very active would not be the term.
Okay.
In fact, we stopped being very active. Well, we were for 15 years, made five albums, including a live album, so that's six. And then in 2005, we kind of split up. People went their separate ways and followed their different muses, and then started making the movie about the birth of jazz. And that's when I started making these instrumental records, misbehaving on the bass, playing it like it's a saxophone or a banjo on the upper registers with echo and delay and all these things that you're not supposed to do.
Of course. Of course.
But we still keep in touch, and we still get together and write a little bit. And, you know, there might be something in the offing just to see what, get back together, because everybody's still alive.
Of course.
That's a plus.
Well, I mean, and it is. And when you guys have that kind of influence over each other, you know, when you're writing something and creating something. And the beautiful thing about, you know, you, Eric, is that, and I know that everybody that's tuned in, they're probably having just a heyday with you and I, because we're just jumping all over the map. And for this one, I'm totally great with that, because we're getting into some really cool stuff with you. Is that this opens up yet another style, you know, that you're a part of. And you know, with all of the trials and tribulations that you've gone through, and the funny, you know, somatics of what you've had to do to get, you know, get to where you are, you know, it's infused a little piece of something in you as far as, you know, the music that you play. Now backing up to, you know, the night that, you know, you met Alice, you know, and Keith and everybody, and then you don't do with anything with them for 5 years and after, you know, after you've met them.
Right.
How do you wind up, you know, we'll backtrack, how do you wind up getting into the Cooper camp?
Well, that, I came back from the failed Kyle Palmer album.
Okay.
In Europe, and a friend just started, you know, went back into, you know, was making that, made an album with Franny Gold to do some LA sessions, and just figuring out, you know, trying to make a living. And I got a call from Dwayne Hitchings saying that, you know, the Alice Cooper was putting together a new band and was auditioning as guys, and so he knew five guys. Yeah, me, Mike Panera, himself, and keyboards, the drummer. Oh, that's four. Yeah, that's four guys.
It's okay. You know what? It could be five if you want it to be. We'll just act like
it was
like
four or five of us. And we went down. We learned four of his songs, Only Women Bleed and a few others. I can't remember what they were. And we played them, and they liked us. And so I guess we got the gig. I mean, I was kind of happening at the time, because I had produced Peter McKeon, and I had just been on American Bandstand.
Oh, wow.
And his single was climbing up the charts. It was number 53. And so, you know, and I seemed, you know, somewhat, so I had some credibility. And plus, you know, rocking, this is spring of 1980, as, you know, was my main thing since the 60s, since forever. So you know, we hit it off, and so I, you know, ended up working with him, and you know, we got all along well. And then gradually, after a bass player, I kind of rose to be his liaison with the band. And then we produced some things together. I started producing some of the stuff in France and in England on an EP and a TV show. So we came back, co-produced that Zipper Catches Skin album, and you know,
and what was,
we did some shows.
Yeah, I mean, what was that? What was what was that part like for you? Because that's another crazy, weird turn, you know, thinking about it.
Well, that was the big rock show. So that was, you know, 1980, he was still very much happening.
Yes.
And 1981, because, for example, on Halloween, I think it was 1981 and Halloween, we went to Detroit. Now, Alice has got two hometowns, so to speak. Detroit, where he and the band had worked for quite a while, and Phoenix.
Okay.
Where he went to high school. So they both lay claim to hometown. So on Halloween, so it's Halloween night, it's Detroit, and it's Alice Cooper. And we're playing Joe Louis Arena, which is 31,000 people, sold out for two nights. So that was, you know, there was a real rock show vibe there. And to a lesser degree, or I don't think it was great, I was going to say to a greater or lesser degree, that, you know, most of those 2 years were like that. And so, you know, for me, I was going, well, this is the big rock show. And it was fun because it was theatrical.
Oh,
so,
yes.
You know, you dressed up, there was some theater involved, and it was not during those years, he didn't use all the props that he uses now and that he had used on the Billion Dollar Babies and the Welcome to My Nightmare. It was stripped down, kind of a special forces.
Ah, yes.
So we were all in paramilitary gear.
Hence the
everybody
picture,
the
yes.
Band, and everybody visible around the stage area, the sound guys, the roadies, anybody that could be seen by the audience had to be in this paramilitary gear, like they were, you know, dropped behind the lines 5 years ago and just resurfaced, you know, kind of bloodied and decorated in whatever gear they wanted.
Okay. Yeah, that explains that, you know, the picture that I was able to, you know, create when I was, you know, letting everybody know you're going to be on air with us today on Radio Memphis, the, you know, the beret and everything. And it was very, you know, it was very stoic, you know, you were standing
well,
in that picture.
I think he named the band for a while, and the Special Forces tour, we were called Hostage Fever.
Oh, nice. Perfect. Now,
but this was also... Oh, maybe that was the Fush the Fashion Tour. It was called Hussein. But anyway, because it was around the time when Iraq or Iran had the American hostages.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's right. I didn't even think about that. That's right.
And he's always got a finger on the international political and on current events. He always, you know,
of course.
He follows that and always has used that in some of his writing.
And trying to put that in. Now for you, okay, so you're part of a rock show, you know, and there's theatrics and everything that's somewhat involved. How does that affect you as far as, you know, music and playing and stuff? I mean, is this something that you wind up going, oh my God, this is exciting, and does it change the way you play? Does it help the way you play when you realize that there's little theater that's coming into play for you? What does that do for you?
Well, there was more theater involved, of course. The theatrical element was to a greater degree than I had done before in my life, or right. Since. But as far as, you know, stylistically, when I think musicians, they get to a certain level of competence or expertise, if you will.
Sure.
And they work there, and the ones that keep getting better. If you do a tour, like, you know, hook up with an artist, like an Alice, say, for example, and you do tours and you record for 2 years, you're in that style, and your chops are up, but you're in that style. Now, the times when you really shift or explore or advance is when you're not really touring so much, but maybe you're woodshedding.
Okay.
In those quiet times between tours or between records, when you're that's when you have the opportunity, and sometimes I haven't, and you don't always. Sometimes you just go party, but sometimes you have the opportunity to woodshed, to expand your abilities, and to play in styles. You know, study some great player. For me, Pino Palladino. Every once in a while, it was a time. There was other ones too, Chuck Rainey, earlier in my career. But Pino Palladino, at one point, I just started some study of his work because he expanded my harmonic boundaries. I became when I picked up the fretless, and I started doing a bunch of different things that you don't want, that aren't required or even wanted in in a lot of ensembles in the bands. You don't play that with Alice Cooper. You don't play that with Kim Carnes. You don't play the stuff I'm doing now on my solo records. They're mine.
And they're yours.
Kind of, you know, when you're doing pop music with singers, the bass has a certain role to play generally, and if it can play some melody as well, that's true. But, you know, I can't do as well. Like now, I'm using different echoes and delays and doing kind of breaking some rules and seeing how much sound I can get, how much I can do with those four strings. And that comes from those times in between where you're working for a name international artist who has a certain style that you need to adhere to.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the thing, you know, and for those of you that have been tuning in, you're tuned into Radio Memphis Around the World, and I am talking to the most awesome Eric Scott Eske. You know, the thing about you is that it's been written, and everybody kind of discusses this very cool, and they use it as they use it and describe it as an evolution from being the bassist, you know, from Alice Cooper to now where you're at with the world music and the Celtic music and everything. You know, and there's a, you know, Eric, there's a thing for you about, you know, once you really started researching, and once you started really kind of expanding your horizons on the stylistic things that you do with your music and what it ultimately is that you're trying, and, you know, nothing more than you were just trying to see what that bass could do. You know, did you purposely go into the styles of music, you know, into the contemporary you know, world music that you're getting in, that you're in, and that you're well known for now? I mean, was that a purpose thing, or was that I just found myself thing?
You know, Sonia Dada stopped the cycle of recording, touring, rehearsing, writing, and and I was in the studio, and I had an opportunity. Well, what am I going to do now? Well, I was older, and I had some success, and I decided now would be the time to experiment, because I, as a producer, as a writer, I always had lots of melody ideas. As a bassist, I didn't give those melody ideas to the bass too much. I mean, where I could, but generally the events and the real strong melodies were taken by those instruments which in rock and pop are generally given, those guitars, horns, drums, events, you know. Now I decided, well, I'm going to do it on the bass. What, that horn line, that melody I'm hearing, you know, if I can go up there and play it, does it work? And sometimes I had a great melody, and I would say, and it worked. You know, up in the melody, was, and I would add echo and some flanging and a different sound. So on the first record, I got a lot of reviewing comments that were, there's an interesting bunch of guitar sounds on this album.
Okay.
And of course, there were no guitar sounds on the album. They were all bass in the upper register. So, and that was cool. And something that didn't always work, sometimes I would write a song, and I'd go, this, I think there's two songs you requested, Gypsy Mother and the Royal Bastard and Free. And in both cases, to a degree, the violin carried the melody and at times as good or better.
Yes.
And so I said, and Free, when you hear Free, there's I mean, when you hear the intro, I wrote the intro, and I was playing it on bass, and you know, and I get into keyboards and all that stuff, and I go, well, this is not quite what I wanted. And I tried instruments, pianos or guitar thing, I went to my the keyboard, and then I finally tried a string patch, and I went, oh, well, probably, maybe a violin. And of course, and in hindsight, there's a haunting melody that kind of conjures the image of a lonely guy on top of a fog-shrouded hill after a battle.
Yes.
And what instrument do you think is going to work better, a violin or a bass? I mean, it's funny when you think, look back on it. Well, of course the violin is going to be haunting.
Of course. That's the emotional thing. That's what you're tapping into.
Exactly.
You're tapping into the theatrics, if you will, you know, of that. You know, and ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, you wind up, you know, coming up with some insane sounds, and you go to some really cool places. And I have to tell you, you know, my day, and a lot of people, and not that I always talk about my day, you know, when I'm on air and stuff, but, you know, my day started kind of really screwy this morning, you know, and I was running in here, and I was running late and stuff like that. I promise you, the second that, you know, I sat down, and the second that, you know, your music started playing right before I was getting ready, you know, to pull you in on air, all of a sudden I felt calm, and all of a sudden I felt really happy, and all of a sudden I had this warm and fuzzy feeling, and I was like this, you know, and it was like somebody was petting my hair.
Okay. The Nine Lives, right?
That's it.
That's real good. I managed to get that one kind of right.
Yes, that one, you know, and it did that for me, and it was one of those that, you know, that kind of music, you know, is very emotional, you know, music, you know, especially for me.
I tend to write from the heart. I mean, there's the head, the heart, and the booty, right?
All right. So this one's from the heart. Which styles are from the head, and which styles are from the booty?
Well, you know, when you're younger, there's that just visceral energy, and the hormones are raging, and you got that going on.
Of course.
And sometimes that's the only thing that matters. And then later on, you go, well, I got to write some smart lyrics. So then, and jazz. Jazz is so intellectual. That's from the head. But there's always an element of heart, and right now, that's kind of where I am in my life.
You threw me off my rocker, man. You're so right in that statement, Eric. You're right. You're absolutely right. But the heart always wins. It doesn't. And just so you know, it doesn't matter what age you are. The heart always wins it over. Just so you know that.
Yeah. Well, and in answer to your question, do you ask? Did I plan this? No, not at all. I just started going. I started experimenting. Well, I'm going to do this stuff and see what I can get away with playing the bass and melodies, and see if I can make any music that's worth listening to. And, you know, it came out kind of okay, and it's kind of found a home in this genre that I didn't really even knew existed. I had heard the term New Age and kind of shuddered.
Well, yeah, because you were thinking in your mind that if I went that route, I mean, think about it. Everybody knew you, you know, for being like that rock icon, you know what I mean? And look at the people that you toured with and stuff. And if you were to go to that route, everybody would feel like that you were selling out the rock side of your world. But what you didn't realize is that you were opening up your entire planet for yourself.
Yeah, and it's so much free. I feel like I'm using so much more of me when I get to play, you know, self-produce these records with it and melody and play the stuff like that to a degree. And there's no words, so there's no signposts dictating how you're going to feel. It's just, so it's all about feel and heart and like music plays, and all of a sudden, you know, you're cool. That's cool. I feel cool. That's good. I feel good.
See?
And then that's great. And I'm not making music now that you want to get jacked up for. You know, this is not aerobic stuff, or this is not going to work at halftime in the Super Bowl. You know, that stuff is to get you all jacked up and amped up. This is to kind of, you know, chill you out, and this is cool. I don't need to get jacked up and drama. I don't need any drama.
Now you said it. You're talking about the world and the drama. This is you being free. This is you being, you know, being really kind of zen with where you're at in your life at the moment in time.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Cosmic, yeah. I will occasionally go off world.
Okay, all right, and there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes you need to, you need to do some things like that, and as far as the styles and things like that, it's been awesome to listen to, where your music has gone from where you started, because personally, that stuff, as far as I see it, I think that stuff is always trapped in you, from day one, and it just hides. And it just hides and hides and hides, and it waits for you to be ready for it. That's my thing.
I agree with you. You should play one of those tunes now, because this is the perfect lead-in.
It is the perfect lead-in, Absolutely, it's the perfect lead-in. I'll tell you what I am going to do. I am going to go ahead and play one of your tunes. Let me see which one have I got lined up for you. What I need to do is I need to stop down. I need to do a quick commercial break anyway. But since we are talking about Gypsy Mother and the Royal Bastard, I think that we're going to play that next after the commercial break. What do you think?
I think it's a good idea.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. You hold tight for me, baby, and we'll get everybody ready to hear some more of you right here in Radio Memphis. Hold on for me.
All right.
Mr. Eric Scott. And I'm going to tell you what, man. How cool is it that he knows when you guys need to hear some more of his music. So I'll tell you what. Let's go ahead. We're going to stop down, take a quick commercial break. Coming up by the commercial break, we've got some more Eric Scott music for you right here only on Radio Memphis.
Don't forget, you can take Radio Memphis wherever you go. Get the TuneIn app and search for Radio Memphis. You can also get the Radio Memphis app in the Google Play Store for Android devices. Plus, radio-memphis.com is mobile-enabled through your mobile device's web browser. Keep it mobile on Radio Memphis.
You love rock and roll. You have your favorite bands. Now get their merch at the worldfamousrock.com at radio-memphis.com. Not only is there stuff for bands, you'll find things for sports teams, movies, show posters, patches, stickers, wall art, and yes, tickets. You can even get music. Find the rock.com banner at radio-memphis.com and look for the code that can save you $5 on your order right now. Get the merch and celebrate your favorite bands and more with rock.com at radio-memphis.com. Real merch for real fans.
There are a ton of vape products out there. Here's how you get the lowest price guaranteed on all your vaping products. Mods, starter kits, tanks, parts and accessories, and atomizers. You can even get free shipping on select orders. From juices to customized rigs, look for the UR Vaping banner at radio-memphis.com to get a great deal on all your vaping needs. Sign up now for a 10% discount on your order. UR Vaping at radio-memphis.com.
Travel can be pricey, not to mention all the work you put into getting the best rates for flights, hotels, and vacation packages. Take a look at the Cheapo Air banner ad at radio-memphis.com. You'll see promo codes right on our website that can save you some serious money on all sorts of travel services. Flights, hotels, cars, cruises, vacations, and more are just a click away at the Cheapo Air banner ad at radio-memphis.com.
Millions of people here in America are cutting the cable and jumping into the wonderful world of streaming TV. Now you can too with Roku. You can even listen to Radio Memphis on it. Roku has led the way in streaming services and continues to be innovative with their latest products like the Roku Express, the Streaming Stick, and the new Roku Ultra featuring 4K, HDR, quad-core processing, voice search, remote finder, and so much more. Look for the exclusive deals on Roku systems at radio-memphis.com. Take a musical trip around the world with D. Radio Memphis Around the World, Saturdays at 1 p.m. Central on Radio Memphis.
Oh,
That's Eric Scott for you right here on Radio Memphis. You're tuned in to Radio Memphis Around the World with me, D. How about that right there? Gypsy Mother and the Royal Bastard. And of course, that right there is off of the album As the Earth Bleeds. Sorry about that. Hanging out with Mr. Eric Scott right now. How are you doing, honey?
Hey.
There you are.
There was a little noise on the phone. There was a cosmic ghost in the machine, and it went,
gah! The cosmic ghost, yes. Yes, the song that I just played for everybody, you know, that one right there, off the album, And the Earth Bleeds. What was funny about that album is that, you know, that was actually your sophomore album, you know, as far as solo artist. Other Planets, you know, before that. First one, everybody was like, okay, where's he going? What's he doing? This is when you start really kind of, you know, showing the other side of your musical talent. This one comes out, you know, and everybody is extremely excited. They're happy, you know, they're like, oh my God, he's going somewhere. And in fact, you know, it's even, you know, some of the remarks, you know, that I saw that was coming across, some of the articles, you know, they were saying, you know, a rocking bassist takes trips down unconventional musical roads, apparently with no rules, no signposts, and with the sophomore album, you know, he's actually doing some more things. He's conjuring up, you know, newer versions of his own artistry, and everybody starts really latching on to you at this point with this particular album, you know, with the new age style that you're going. And, you know, how did you feel about that?
Well, I was confused. I was, after then, the first two records I was just making because I could and I wanted to, and I suppose there was some artistic arrogance in that I was not targeting any genre or targeting any market, you know. I was just making music. And that was the second one, Land the Earth Bleeds, is the one that has vocals. It has like, I think five or six of the tracks have vocals. Not all by me, thankfully. In marketing that, I discovered that there was a genre out there, that, you know, under the umbrella of New Age, it's contemporary instrumental world. It's a big morphing thing that broke my idea of what I thought New Age had to be in the electronica and stuff. It was not that at all. It's a broad, much broader umbrella. And so then once I realized that, actually, I took the first two albums, Other Planets and Earth Bleeds, and rearranged and remixed and got rid of the vocals and turned it into the third album. I added a couple tracks, but Spirits.
Ah.
That became the one that I said, well, okay, I should probably be professional about this, and I should probably aim for this market where they like predominantly instrumentals.
I
took the vocals off, edited, and where the vocals had been, added other instrumentations, and did Spirits. In fact, that Gypsy Mother and Royal Bastard is edited down and changed is also on Spirits. So the Spirits and the last album, In the Company of Clouds, is where I actually started making music with a market and a purpose in mind, you know, and didn't just let myself go crazy and put, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, and it's funny, I'm glad you mentioned that, Eric, because, you know, when you were doing And the Earth Bleeds, you know, you actually had sat down and you'd talked to on some particular interviews. And one of the things that you had told at that time in your life, and this is what was going through your head, you know, this is a quote from you, okay, that there are people who carefully plan out the direction of their music, smart. Then there's me. I pretty much have no idea at the start. I get in the music room, I start messing around on something, bass, guitar, chord changes on the keyboard, or a beat on the beat programmer. If I like something, I just start to build. And of course, and you were like, you know, and you were very honest. You were like, I have no idea. I'm just going in and it's going to come out.
Guilty. I can't deny. You looked it up. That sounds like a quote I did do. Guilty as charged.
It's in print. Baby, it's in print, man. I'll send you a copy.
Yeah, I believe it. I remember it. No, it's actually true. You know, I had never, you know, and I still don't to a degree, but while I'm producing the record, I realize there are certain limitations. I'm probably not going to put a vocal on it if I'm going to market it as the instrumental. As an instrumental, obviously I'm not going to put vocals on it, and there's a certain things, but up till then, the first two records, I was just in there and just letting it fling and letting it fly.
Sure.
And then it was, you know, and then confronted the music business portion of the program and went, oh, geez, you know, I suppose I have to pay a little more attention to the genre and marketing slots so I don't put, you know, try to get a round peg in a square hole, so I try to keep the rock a little separate from the groove.
Well, Okay.
I don't know how to explain that, but you know.
I do, and I understand what you just said, Eric. But here's the thing: up until this point in your whole world, when have you ever followed rules?
Well, exactly. So, you're right. So, in fact, from the very first album, Other Planets, I wanted to not make music that you could hear on the radio that everybody always listens to, like everybody else's. What's the sense? There's a boatload of music out there. Everybody can turn on the radio and hear the same stuff.
Right.
The same formula stuff. So I deliberately, you know, instead of having an intro into the verse, I had an intro into a chorus, and it was supposed to happen four times, I have it three times. I would change the instrumentation, you know, which is the bass playing the lead a lot gets me away for that. And then the drum sounds, I would change everything a little bit, so deliberately, it was different. You know, no sense in making the same stuff that everybody else has been making, or the same stuff that I have been making for 50 years. So, yeah, I do try to break rules.
Okay. Well, and like I said, the formulaic, thing that you've come up with, all right, you know, is obviously working for you. And then, yes, as far as with the instrument.
But I don't have a formulaic thing.
Well, you do to an extent. You just don't realize it's yours. you have a method to your madness. I mean, to a certain extent, you don't even realize you do.
Okay, that's probably true.
All right, I'm poking. You know, and at the same token, you being able to kind of incorporate whatever, whenever, and however. You know, you're able to. I mean, you're literally able to. I mean, yours is a decision, you know, based on, you know, on feel, you know, and it's if this album or this music or this moment, you know, dictates to you in your heart that, okay, no music is gonna, or no singing is gonna be here, or I need violin here, or I need this here, you know, you've got, you know, you have that talent where at any moment that you can pull from any tool in your box to, you know, insert and complete a picture. So for you, I mean, for me looking at you and looking in and listening and stuff, I mean, for you, it could be anything. You don't even have to stick to a certain deal. I mean, that is your formula. You don't stick to anything.
Oh, okay. I'll buy that.
Yeah, okay.
Make sure I don't have a formula. I just don't. If it starts to sound like anything you've heard, I go, no. No sense in making that.
Well, I tell you, and you know, since we're on the subject, one of the things, you know, over the course of time in history that you've kind of talked about, you know, and there's been moments where, you know, people have asked you, you know, for advice, you know, for the up and coming, and you know, and for, you know, things that they should, you know, follow, and you know, and we've had such a fun time, you know, talking about, you know, you showing up at the right moments at the right time, or just being where you needed to be, or going through, you know, the craziness you had to go through, you know, to kind of get where you're going. At one point, you know, you had made a noted remark about, you know, the recording and music, which makes sense because of you wanting to expound on the sounds and styles that you're creating for yourself at this moment in time. And, you know, I loved the quote that you made was that, you know, you had to literally find your own deal, find your own sound. So if everybody went and bought the same amp, or if everybody went and bought the same, you know, the same deal to record on or whatever the case may be and turned up, you know, there would be nothing original, you know, and that was a thing for you. You know, and it was, you know, a thing for you was that you wanted everybody to pretty much, you know, search out, you know, their ability on whatever it is that they had. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's definitely true. I mean, since back, when rock was first, I mean, if you go back to the 60s or 70s, there was a time when you could identify the artist before the voice came in, because there was a music style to it, the sound of the guitar or the drum or the whatever it was. Now, even if it's a rock channel, you can't, you know, you can't tell who it is or who it's going to be until maybe the voice comes in.
Right.
Because the guitar sounds, the drums, everything is, they say, oh, I want to sound like, you know, that. And when it first started, back then, nobody had the same gear. Nobody had the same stuff. And then it started, like, for example, oh, Eddie Van Halen came out. I want that guitar sound. So all of a sudden, everybody, that guitar sound is available to all the producers and all the studios, the same sort of compressors and distortion devices and amps.
Yep.
And everybody, gradually, everybody starts to sound exactly alike. And from the sound to drum sound, I want to sound like that. And then all of a sudden, everybody sounds exactly alike. And so I think that, yeah, you got to somehow search out a reason, your own style, not, or just try to avoid something It sounds just exactly like somebody else, because what's the point?
There is no point. That's kind of how I feel about it, you know. And then when you're, you know, it's funny because when, you know, you'll have, and you hear this, you know, this, I'm going to use this, I'm just going to make up an example. But, you know, a young band runs up to you, man, and it's like, we sound just like AC/DC. Sign us. And it's like, well, why would I do that? We already have one.
There's a great one. I mean, and to a degree, a young band, I think if a young band came out and had a sound like AC/DC, they would get signed immediately for in a minute. They might have a one-year career and bring back the guitars. Because although there is an AC/DC, a lot of people, how many people play that stuff anymore in classic rock radio? It's just...
Okay.
It's just, I mean, it, well, does, because that's... Yeah, 50 years, if there's two generations in between sounds, you can probably get away with it.
You think?
But if we're making the same stuff that's been made for the last 20,
mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? We did a rock album once, Signal, got a deal with EMI, and had this one power ballad. It was 1989.
Okay.
And it was great, and it was nobody was doing that. But then Angel came out with Aerosmith.
Yes.
Remember that big power ballad?
Yes.
And then... Everybody starts doing, then it starts raining power ballads. When that album came out 8 months later, 9 months later, it was too late. Now we're a copycat. We're just a bunch of everybody copying the power ballad theme. And so, you know, you can't copy what's on the radio thinking that's going to give you success, because that's what people are playing, that's what people are hearing. I'm going to do that, because then you'll just be a copy band that's playing you that. And no, you need to just somehow stick to what you're doing. And, if you have your own individual style and it's good, then people can't get that. They can't get that anywhere else. They're going to come to your record.
You're right. You're exactly right, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, that's exactly the way it's supposed to be. And there was, I mean, and there's a very marked thought when you're talking about those things. Us, you know, at Radio Memphis, you know, we talk about, you know, a lot of the artists, and we talk about, you know, as far as recording, you know what I mean? And it's funny because I work with some pretty cool people. And Brad Dunn, you know, he does the stuff with American Recording Studios and things like that. He's markedly done some amazing things, and he happens to be the nephew of Duck Dunn, the Blues Brothers. Okay.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So that's you know who we work with, and you know, and he helped actually format and lay out a recording studio for us here. And you know, one of the lessons I had learned, you know, it was funny because he was laying some stuff out. We were talking about stuff with Pro Tools and all this stuff, and he was like, you know, D, he goes, when you're talking about, you know, certain things and certain programs and certain apps and all this, he goes, you're just manipulating zeros and ones, okay? He goes, but when you're talking about real recording, you know what I mean? He goes, you know, you have to have this certain deal and this certain vibe. And he goes, now, if everybody comes in and they say that I want this amp and I want you to use this deal on Pro Tools and I want you to use this thing, he goes, you can only manipulate it to a certain point. You know what I mean? And he goes, and it gets to the point where if a rock band, or, you know, a blues band, you know, a pop band or a country band comes in and they all record under those same settings, he goes, no, you can't tell what genre it is. They all start sounding the same across the wash.
Exactly.
And so you've been screaming that for many years. You know, you're like, dude, go get your own stuff. Do your own thing.
Yeah. I mean, even if it seems like it's a different sound, it's not that guitar sound that you loved, you know, don't try to get that. Get something that's, and make it your own style. If it feels great, music is great. It will be a plus if the sound is somewhat distinctive.
Bingo. When you're recording, do you have this thing like your style, you know, a style of recording? Are you one of those that likes this whole live, you know, live environment, you know, capture it, you know, what you hear is what you get, you know, and this is what we kind of work with, you know, as far as, you know, on the bass tracks on that?
It's, you know, there's no rules. There's just never. Sometimes you play the first take is just great and that's the feel you want, and sometimes it takes longer.
Longer.
And sometimes you can work at it for way. You can do it, you know, and you end up 9 months later coming back to that first thing you did on the so-called demo when you first had this idea and you were just throwing down some stuff, and that just happened to have a certain thing that you liked, and that certain thing that you liked stands the test of time of those 10 months, and you can't duplicate it. You can't make it better. Well, we'll get a better sound when we do it for real. No, back there, the performance is key, and the content, for me, will always out, you know. If it's mono, and it's a great record, it's the Temptations back in 60, you know, that's going to beat some technologically perfect record that's is sterile, and all the emotion and the heart's been sucked right off it in the effort to make it pristinely somehow somebody's definition of perfect. As far as what you're talking about live, when I make my own solo stuff, it's a lot of me in a room.
Yes.
So there's, unfortunately, because there's nothing more fun than creating this so-called quote-unquote magic when you got a bunch of people in the room and you're playing together. Nobody knows exactly what the next guy's going to play, but everybody's got their ears open.
Well, sure.
And a lot of great things happen by accident that you can't really plan.
That's it.
And that would be my favorite way of recording, but in recording solo as I am, I have no choice but to, you know, I come up with an idea, I'll put a little beat on there, and I'll just start playing something until I kind of like something, and I build on that.
Right, right. You know, you've got some cool stuff that you're handling, and I tell you, speaking of, I do know that you are, you have the affinity for Scotland, okay? That's a place where you get a lot of inspiration from. And from what I understand, that was also a place that you kind of went to and where, you know, a lot of this records, you know, and some of the stuff that you're doing now has influenced, you know, as far as your playing. What does going to a place like that do for you?
Well, you never really know what's going to do. I find that I don't want to go somewhere. I don't want to do that. But then if I drag myself somewhere and all of a sudden you get absorbed in a new experience and a new vibe. And in Scotland, yeah, I was making a record, for example, and I went to Scotland during the process. And I thought I had a record that was, or one song or a couple songs that were done. Mm-hmm. Instrumental, and I went to Scotland. And I just got caught up in the vibe and the history. And you know, then it conjured up images of Braveheart, and I went back and looked
Love
at
it.
The actual history and at the actual locations, and you know, and so that in the, I don't know if you're leading up to that one song, but then I ended up coming home and the song that I thought was done, I wrote lyrics for around that, you know, a freedom fighter in 1297,
okay,
in Scotland, and so I think, and I have Scottish ancestry myself. So for that album and for a period there, and I love the fifth below the root, which is a kind of a key to Scottish music. And so I just started doing that a lot. And sometimes it's good, you know. You go to a different environment, take yourself out of your. And with me, I sometimes somewhat fearfully out of my comfort zone, but I end up frequently going, "Oh, that was a good thing to do because I was in a little bit of a rut, maybe."
Okay. And that was something that kind of shook you out of it.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. I will say that, and the reason why I even kind of bring that up, this last track that we're going to be playing, you know, before I have to get off the phone with you, the song "Free." Okay, this was a song that you wound up, you know, doing, and you actually did wind up pulling in some vocals on, the original version. Okay,
I did.
And you know, and there was actually a real, it was kind of a real special. It was kind of a cool story in that, you know, you winded up collaborating with, you know, with specific people to do vocals for you on that song.
Yeah, when I came back, you're handing off the baton to me. Yeah, when I came back from Scotland, I started writing. I came up with a chorus, just a chorus, and I went, "That's I like the harmonies. I the chorus, I dug it. It was free. It was a simple word."
Yes.
And I went, "That's kind of cool. I can dig it." So then I started, and the song itself was kind of mysterious, cosmic, a little bit mythical. So I wanted to write words that were not too literal, but had to sound kind of mythical without being corny.
I got you.
You put it, you know, in the wrong musical environment, and they wouldn't work. So I finally came up with something I thought might work. And Mickey, my wife, whom you had interviewed a couple months ago,
yes,
had been working with a band that were in London. She discovered them, but now they're back in their homeland of Colombia,
okay,
South America. Anna Maria Botero.
Okay.
Anna Maria Botero and Pablo, her man. And so I said, "I'm going to try her voice on this." So I sent it to them down there in South America. I sang him a guide vocal for the melody, of course. And I just laugh at the thought of my guide vocal. And anyway, and so then she took it and she sang on it, and he recorded, Pablo recorded it, and it sounded great. So
and that was
Marie Botero ended up singing on a song called Free.
Yeah, and that was a cool let go moment for you, because that was one of the first times that you were not necessarily there in the room while a recording was going on, kind of overseeing.
Yeah, I don't like to do that. I don't ever do that. It never works. I send it somewhere and it comes back, and it just, you know, I have to be in the room, because I'll be playing something and I'll go, ooh, that, and I'll hear something, that's what we're going to do, and I'll take something, and the player didn't know what he just did, but I know that I'm going to use that somewhere else in the song.
Right.
I really have to be there. I've tried it the other way. It doesn't work. But in this case, because they were in Colombia and I wasn't, I said, why not? And they had a band. I think they still do. It's called Rot Violence.
Yes, they do.
And so I sent it down, and she sang on it a couple times. You sent it back to me, and I said, it was cool. And I just, it didn't take long.
Didn't take long at all, and it wound up actually kind of working out for you, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No question about it. It's better than me singing it, I can tell you that.
Is that the only thing you can't do out of music? Is those instruments to sing? Is that the one thing we got to work on with you, man?
We're gonna give that ship a sail.
No, it's not too bad. It's not too bad. I want to thank you, Eric, for the time that you've been able to spend with me. And I know that we cut off so much. There's so much to you. There's so many layers to you. There's, you know, I need like several shows with you, in order to check in and do some stuff. I want you to know that, you know, not only do I do stuff here at Radio Memphis Around the World, but I also, there's also a show that we do on Monday nights. It's called Radio Memphis Prague Time. Your music is showing up in Prague Time. I'm just going to tell you that now.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and of course, at any moment when we do that show, in the future, I want to see maybe a possible, you know, opportunity for you to maybe kind of check back in if stuff, you know, with the music that's coming in, if you got stuff that's coming up, you know, that kind of thing. Do you have any one piece of information or one piece of advice, other than, you know, stick to your own original sound? Do you have anything else that you would give to somebody that's getting started in this business, you know, now, you know, with the way things are now? Do you have any piece of advice that you would give them and say, this is what you need to do?
Well, persistence, maintain your own woodshed. Don't get to a level and decide you're good enough, because there's always somebody else that's better, and you need to keep improving, because if you're not improving, you're digressing. Improving, you're not going forward, you're going backwards. And yeah, stick to your own style. Don't copy anything at all.
Good deal.
There's the other thing I'll just throw in to you on the Free, which you're about to play.
Okay.
This was that song I was telling you about, where I wrote the melody, and originally, and for a while there, it was working, the intro with the bass. And then I went, no. That's why, and looking back, I laugh at it. And I got Shira Common here in Berkeley, a violinist, to play a 14th or 13th century violin called a viol at the... And so she's on this song. It's the violin you hear. And it's kind of a duet between violin and bass, of course, with Anna Maria singing.
Perfect. That is very perfect. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to play everybody that song, and I'm going to let you enjoy your afternoon. And please, please give my love to Mickey. Tell her I said hello. I need to catch up with her soon anyway.
You bet I will. Thank you. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're going to get on the phone again, so don't worry. I'm not going to let you loose that easy, okay?
Okay.
All right. We'll talk soon, baby.
Thanks.
No problem. Bye. All right, that was Mr. Eric Scott for you guys right here on Radio Memphis Around the World. And the funny thing, as I was saying earlier, you know, with him, there's so much. We didn't even scratch the surface with him. You know, you really need to kind of look up and see what he's got going on. This is a gentleman, you know, that has kind of spanned all times, all right, and has been a part of all different kinds of works, all different kinds of genres and things like that. He keeps reinventing himself. If you want to know more, you know, he does have his own website, ericscottbass.com, and that's Eric with a K, E-R-I-K, Scott, bass.com. Check his stuff out. Check his music out. And, of course, all the stuff that he's got now, you know, as for with the worldly music and you know, and all the cool violins and the Celtic backgrounds and things like that. You'll definitely enjoy that, too, because, you know, for me, you know, for somebody that you know, that's kind of followed the music all through the ages as far as what he's done, this just shows you just how much more, you know, he has opened up, and he's still doing things. And it is somewhat inspiring, especially for our artists here. here on Radio Memphis. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play the song that we've been talking about. This song right here, Free, as he was mentioning, Anna Marie Botero, okay, is featuring her singing on this. She is part of a band called Rotviolent, and you're going to hear probably more about that band. So you guys, I want you to kind of click that into your head and pay attention, you know, because I have a feeling that that one is going to start coming up, you know, after a while too, and so you don't want to miss that. In the meantime, how about some more Eric Scott for you? Here's some Free right here, only on Radio Memphis.
The proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated and originally aired live on Radio Memphis. Any offers or advertisement contained may not still be valid. All rights are reserved and copyright is held by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more, look for all the RMOD players at radio-memphis.com.